Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
More than 50 dead in Nigerian church attacks, and experts say Pistorius had no mental illness on the night he killed his girlfriend. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Suspected Islamist militants have killed at least 50 people in northeastern Nigeria. Local leaders report the gunmen on motorcycles attacked churches in four villages Sunday near Chibok and Borno State. According to witnesses, Nigeria's military either did not respond or was slow to respond after calls for help were made when the attacks began. Speaking for the Nigerian government, spokesman Mike Omeri said the military did respond, but may have been a little late. In South Africa, a report released today from a court-ordered mental health evaluation says Oscar Pistorius did not suffer from a mental illness or defect at the time he shot and killed girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp last year. The report also concludes the Olympic athlete can be held criminally responsible for shooting Steenkamp through a closed bathroom door last year. In court today, a witness for the defense, the orthopedic surgeon Gerald Versfeld, described Pistorius as fearful of his surroundings without the use of his prosthetic legs. The doctor amputated both lower legs when Pistorius was a boy. Iraqi warplanes carried out airstrikes overnight on the northern city of Tikrit. Meanwhile, as the fighting continued in several cities where the militants for the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant took control in a surge beginning in early June. The Iraqi government forces battled Sunni militants north of Baghdad. The militant group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant has formally proclaimed the establishment of an Islamic State in the territories it controls in Iraq and Syria. Edward Duranian reports.
فقررت الدولة الإسلامية ممثلة بأهل الحل والعقد فيها.
It was a symbolic declaration and one that many supporters of an Islamic world order have long awaited. The Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant spokesman spiced his declaration with verses from the Quran and insisted the caliphate would be for the glory of the Islamic nation. Abu Muhammad al-Adnani insisted the historic borders of the region, including those of Syria and Iraq, have now fallen, and proclaimed the group's leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, to be caliph of the self-proclaimed state. He warned Muslims of the region to support him. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Russian, German, and French leaders are to hold another telephone conference with Ukraine's new president today to continue trying to end the conflict in eastern Ukraine. VOA's Al Pessin reports from London.
The Western and Russian leaders want the relative lull in fighting to continue, but Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko is under public pressure to resume his offensive against Russian-backed separatists. At the same time, the French and German leaders want Russian President Vladimir Putin to influence the separatists to end the conflict. But Mr. Putin is resisting, claiming he does not control the fighters in eastern Ukraine. And Russian officials say fears of what they call fascists and radicals in Kyiv are justified. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
India took another step today in its ambitions to tap the commercial potential of its space program by launching satellites from four nations. Prime Minister Narendra Modi commended the country's space program as the world's most cost-effective. India's Polar Satellite launch vehicle blasted off today from the eastern port of Sriharikota, carrying a 714-kilogram French Earth Observation Satellite and four smaller satellites. The Prime Minister witnessed the launch and pointed that all five satellites were put into orbit were for advanced countries. A General Motors compensation expert says the automaker will offer millions of dollars in compensation to victims of accidents caused by defective ignition switches. Kenneth Feinberg says compensation will be paid to people who were driving cars of a specific make and model and year known to have problems with ignition switches. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The new beginning is a new South Sudan where I would want to see the war to stop and have a South Sudan free from ethnic politics and embrace all the critical reforms, including institutionalization of the federal system. This South Sudan will only come if a new leadership emerges.
That's a high-ranking member of the South Sudan ruling party explaining why he is defecting to join anti-government rebels. Details coming up.
Also in the news, suspected Islamist militants have attacked churches in several towns in northeastern Nigeria. And China reopens its embassy in Somalia.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Tanzania, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Top story this hour. Suspected Islamist militants have attacked churches in several towns in northeastern Nigeria, leaving at least 24 people dead. Witnesses and local officials say gunmen on motorcycles attacked the villages yesterday near Chibok in Borno State. Witnesses accused the Nigerian military of being slow to respond to the attack. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility. In April, rebels from the militant group Boko Haram kidnapped more than 270 girls from a school in Chibok. Officials say 219 of them remain unaccounted for. The violence yesterday is the latest in a series of attacks in northeastern Nigeria that has continued despite the government declaring a state of emergency and sending extra troops to the region. During a five-year insurgency in Nigeria's northeast, Boko Haram militants have killed thousands of people, attacked schools, churches, mosques, bus stations, and other public places. They say they want to establish an Islamic state.
South Sudan rebels announced today that a high-ranking member of the South Sudan leadership is joining the opposition. Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa, where months of peace talks have failed to produce an end to the conflict.
One high-ranking member of the South Sudan ruling party, SPLM, announced Monday to join the rebels who have been fighting against the ruling party and President Salva Kiir since December. The defector, Ezekiel Lol Gatkuot, is one of the 11 former political detainees. He is also the former ambassador for South Sudan to the United States and the United Nations. He says he has decided to join the opposition under the leadership of former Vice President Riek Machar to realize a new South Sudan.
The new beginning is a new South Sudan where I would want to see the war to stop and have a South Sudan free from ethnic politics and embrace all the critical reforms, including institutionalization of the federal system. This South Sudan will only come if a new leadership emerges.
A group of 11 SPLM leaders were arrested after fighting broke out mid-December. They were accused by President Kiir of plotting a coup and were only released after international pressure. Seven of the 11 political leaders were released in February. These seven stated that they would not join either side and wanted to join the peace talks as a third party in order to be neutral. The last four detainees were only released in May. Gatkuot is the only one to join the opposition, but believes the 11 political leaders were never really neutral as they had raised issues of corruption, nepotism and other matters to President Kiir before the war broke out. He says that all former detainees are championing reforms.
My colleagues who are still in that category of former detainees, we are one and we will continue to be one. And we will work together to bring changes in our country, changes that we have been calling for, reforms, critical reforms.
Peace talks between the warring parties have made little progress so far. Three agreements were signed, including a ceasefire that has been repeatedly violated by both sides. The two sides were given 60 days in June to set up a transitional government of unity. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Thank you, Marta. South Sudanese church leaders, women's groups, and students are adding their voices to the growing call for a federal system of government in the young country. Nabil Biagio voices this report by Bonifacio Taban, who was in Kampala and spoke to some of the advocates for federalism.
Regina Tab Delang is from Lear County in Unity State. She says from a woman's point of view, a federal system of government is the best option for South Sudan.
We see it as the only option that will give women full participation in the country's affairs. We think the federal system will pave the way to a better future for our children, a future of education and employment opportunities.
The South Sudanese opposition has been calling at peace talks in Addis Ababa for a federal system of government in South Sudan. They say it will ensure equitable resource distribution in all states and bring other positive changes. A member of parliament from the Unity State Legislative Assembly, who asked not to be named, says federalism will likely cut crime because it would allow states to amend laws and make them tougher.
The federal system will address a gap between the communities where we're making crisis among themselves through new constitution that is going to be amended on the current moment, and also it will address the geographical gap between the people of South Sudan that being practiced their own leadership in their own areas. And the federal system is a more advantage because as it happened in so many countries that bordering South Sudan or Sudan.
The lawmaker says those opposed to a federal system say it will cause states with fewer resources to fall behind the more wealthy ones. But he says those fears are unfounded. Abraham Tuach Kir is a bishop from the Evangelical Covenant Church of South Sudan in Upper Nile State. He says the church supports the idea of federalism because it believes the system under which power is shared between the central and state governments will help end the ongoing conflict.
We advocate that the federal system is very good. It would minimize some of problem in South Sudan because it is a good system. We have seen in Ethiopian was working with a federal system. So they were very quiet. We, the role of the church, we really advocate or we support a federal system.
Samuel Guy Quinin, who is originally from Unity State, says having a federal system will create more job opportunities in South Sudan. According to anti-poverty NGO Oxfam, unemployment in South Sudan is extremely high. Only 12% of women and 11% of men are formally employed, Oxfam says.
That will be the opportunity for youth to get jobs because it will not squeeze themselves in a central government whereby they couldn't get jobs. Every year we graduated, but most of the graduates, they're just loitering around under the tree, and the government also always blame the youth, but they don't have the jobs. I do support the party government. That will be an opportunity for us, we youth of South Sudan.
At a meeting held on Saturday at Kampala International University, around 150 students from Unity State's 9 counties passed a resolution in support of federalism in South Sudan. William Malik Bol, the chairman of the Students' Union, says federalism is the only choice for South Sudanese.
Come out with a resolution that what even South Sudanese is needed is a federal system. And we had our voice to the people of Equatoria, the youth of Equatoria, and other youth of South Sudan who are calling for a federal system.
South Sudan is made up of more than 64 tribes, but backers of federalism say that under the current system of centralized power, minority tribes are denied basic services and sound infrastructure because the large tribes dominate power. He also says the transitional constitution gives the president too much power, including the right to remove directly elected state governors, something President Salva Kiir has done in the past, including in Unity State.
That was Nabil Biagio voicing a report by Bonifacio Taban on the debate over federalism in South Sudan.
According to the Associated Press, China will reopen its embassy in Somalia. The move comes 23 years after Beijing evacuated its diplomats as the East African nation plunged into civil war. Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lee said the decision came after Somalia established its first government and parliament in 21 years. He said Beijing would send a delegation to Somalia tomorrow. Somalia has entered a new stage of its peace process, Hong told reporters at a regular briefing. He said the move brings a new opportunity for the development of China-Somalia relations. Chinese diplomats left Somalia in January 1991 after a long-time dictator was overthrown and warlords turned on each other, plunging the impoverished country into chaos.
Also, a report by mental health experts say South African runner Oscar Pistorius was not affected by a mental defect or mental illness when he fatally shot his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp. The athlete's murder trial resumed today after being on hold for a month while he underwent evaluations by a team of psychiatrists and a psychologist. The court ordered the test after a defense witness testified that Pistorius had an anxiety disorder that could have contributed to the shooting last year. The prosecutor read two passages from the panel's report today that say there was no mental condition that would have prevented Pistorius from being criminally responsible for the shooting. Both the prosecutor and the defense attorney said both sides accept the basic findings of the report, but each said there may be individual factual statements they may want to contest later in testimony. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehis Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Suspected Islamist militants have attacked churches in several towns in northeastern Nigeria. A high-ranking member of the South Sudan leadership is joining the opposition. And China reopens its embassy in Somalia. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A recently released report on agriculture in Africa points to entrepreneurship as the key to improving and sustaining food production on the continent. The report, Small and Growing Entrepreneurship in African Agriculture, was released in London last week by the Montpellier Panel. The panel is a group of agriculture and trade experts from Europe and Africa working together to improve food sustainability in sub-Saharan Africa. The report calls for increased investment for entrepreneurship in the rural food sector and cites agriculture as the key sector for creating jobs for African youth. Daniel Gadd is an entrepreneur who heads Omega Farms just outside of Addis Ababa. He spoke with me about the significance of the new report.
Africa produces over $280 billion worth of agriculture products, and most of that production is not in the value chain and it does not involve youth employment, does not involve entrepreneurs. Most of it is raw grain and raw cereals that are produced by a very poorly paid farmers.
As an entrepreneur yourself with running the Omega Farms business just outside of Addis Ababa, what would you say are some of your biggest challenges right now?
One of the biggest challenges, retaining youth employment, keeping the young men and women who are from the rural countryside to stay and work there, to grow and develop and become entrepreneur and business people. The young women are attracted by jobs into the urban communities, young men as well. The development of the urban centers is forcing a lot of migration into the cities because the wages are higher, more rewarding, and more interesting work. Agriculture is perceived as a bit old-fashioned, not rewarding, not dynamic, does not have a lot of things to do with the internet or any of the new technologies. I would like to see more entrepreneurial opportunities for young women and men in the rural countryside. And as you see in the report, the Montpellier report refers to the need for development of training and education programs in entrepreneurial skills, and maybe some form of incubation system to teach young women and men how to become businessmen, how to develop new products, new services, and get more into the value chain in the rural countryside.
Another one of the perceptions regarding agriculture that young people may see is in the technology of it. I mean, when they're looking at maybe a big old tractor that is not doing the work that it should do. So one thing is needed is technology. So how do you get the funding and the programs that are going to give the necessary technology that is needed to keep up with agriculture?
Kim, you're absolutely right that you hit it on the head. This is the challenge. The challenge is to create the opportunity for young women and men to be able to take advantage of mobile technology. We have examples in Nigeria and as well as in Kenya and many parts of Africa, and in Ethiopia. We also have some internet-based services that are directly related to new and emerging opportunities and jobs for young men and women in the rural countryside. The challenge for those of us in agriculture in Africa that the Montpellier panel report has pointed out to is to find a way to get financing that is patient capital, that is in quantities that are small enough for young entrepreneurs to be able to take advantage of and manage their cash flow and their working capital to be able to develop all these new services. And there is money out there, but we're trying to find a way how to make it work for the young women and men who are trying to become entrepreneurs in the new agriculture in Africa.
Do you think the international community is focusing enough on agricultural projects and putting the funding there so that more jobs and more technology can be created to bring young people into the sector?
Well, they are. You have programs like Feed the Future, which is committed at very high levels by President Obama. The United Kingdom has committed to the nutrition side in significant numbers. So there are billions involved here. But we are producing food. We're going to increase production of food. But we need young women and men to be able to process food, package food, label food, develop new products and services that are nutritious for the emerging economies in Africa.
That was Daniel God, managing editor of Omega Farms. He spoke with me from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The Italian Navy Mare Nostrum Rescue Mission says they are towing a disabled fishing boat packed with about 600 African refugees to the Sicilian port of Pozzallo. An estimated 30 of the migrants on board have died from exposure or drowning. Officials said the disabled fishing boat is part of a weekend total of 5,000 refugees expected to land on Italian shores in the next 2 days. Most smuggling efforts take place from Libyan shores on unsafe boats destined from the Italian island of Lampedusa. Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi appealed to the European Union for support of their efforts to rescue refugees who risk their lives on the Mediterranean. Mediterranean migration grew during the early days of the Arab Spring. More than 60,000 attempted the voyage in 2013. In the first 6 months of this year, more than 50,000 have attempted the voyage.
Minutes past the hour. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. In Zimbabwe, police say while the crime rate in general has gone down by 14% this year, cases of rape against juveniles are rising at an alarming level. Speaking at a recent graduation of officers in Harare, Police Commissioner General Augustine Chihuri said that there were 1,384 cases of rape of young girls in the first 5 months of last year, and the number of cases increased to 1,494 during the same period this year. He said a concerted effort is needed to fight sexual crimes. In comments to reporter Ntukamili Nkomo, lawmaker Tabitha Kumala expressed shock at the rape statistics.
These statistics are shocking. And sadly, they are disheartening because rape, obviously, some of these rapes are going to be associated to HIV and AIDS infection. And as a country, we need to move like lightning to deal with this issue of rape sooner than later. Because at the end of the day, every woman, every girl child is going to be infected with AIDS. And they are all being sent to death because we are not doing anything as a country. I think the time has come for us to bite the bullet and deal with this rape issue decisively and strongly.
Would you say the legislature is doing everything that it should be doing to fight this scourge?
I want to believe as legislature we can do more. There is a need for us to raise awareness on the rights of the girl child in terms of the girl child and the boy child in terms of their bodies. Who is allowed to touch their bodies and who is not allowed to touch their bodies? Because these are minors who are looking up to the same adult, which adult is violating them. So there's need for them to know that the adult has no right to touch their bodies and violate them. The moment we raise that awareness, we are then a step ahead, and I think there's need for now in schools, there must be a syllabus that deals with issues of rape on these kids so that they are educated whilst young.
That was Tabitha Kamala in Bulawayo. She was speaking with reporter Ntungamili Nkomo.
The Prime Minister of Tunisia says two Tunisian diplomats kidnapped 4 months ago in Libya were released Saturday. Gunmen abducted the Tunisian officials in separate attacks in March and April. They were expected to arrive in Tunis by plane. Tunisian Prime Minister Mehdi Joma said gunmen from Shabab al-Tawhid had demanded freedom for Libyans being held in Tunis on terrorism charges. Joma said no negotiations were held prior to release of the diplomats. Political crisis since the 2011 ouster of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi have divided Libya and led to a string of kidnappings and killings in the past 2 years. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Suspected Islamist militants have attacked churches in several towns in northeastern Nigeria. A high-ranking member of the South Sudan leadership is joining the opposition. And China reopens its embassy in Somalia. Coming up, we have music from Tanzania. And in our feature segment, we begin the award-winning presentation of our encore that takes us inside South Africa's beer industry. I'm Kim Lewis with the Heya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. Sports is next.
Put your flags up in the sky.
And of course, it's time now for sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga, sitting in for Sonny Young today. Hey, Douglas, what's up?
Hey, Kim. Thanks. We are going to start in Brazil again.
All right, go.
Thank you. Thanks to two late goals, France fought off a spirited effort from Nigeria to advance the quarterfinals with a 2-0 victory in Brasilia. Paul Pogba's header and Joseph Yobo's own goal knocked out Nigeria. Pogba headed home after Enyema's misjudgment before Yobo diverted Matthew Valbuena's cross into the net. Now France will play the winner of Monday's other game between Germany and Algeria in the quarterfinals on Friday. France joined Costa Rica and the Netherlands, who both reached the quarterfinals in dramatic fashion, already beating the odds by advancing out one of the most difficult first-round groups. Costa Rica shocked Greece in a penalty-kick shootout Sunday. The teams ended regular and extra time tied 1-1, and Costa Rica made all five of its kicks from the penalty spot to prevail 5-3. Earlier Sunday in Fortaleza, the Netherlands stunned Mexico with two late goals in a 2-1 victory. This is the first time Costa Rica has reached the World Cup quarterfinals. The Netherlands will play Costa Rica in the quarterfinals next Saturday. Later on Monday, Africa's only remaining team, Algeria, takes on Germany. The U.S. team takes aim at a quarterfinal berth when it plays Belgium on Tuesday. Also Tuesday, Argentina goes against Switzerland.
This is VOA's Nikki Nicole Lindsay. I want you to know that Sonny welcomes your comments. You can send your emails to Sonny at the following address. Sonny@voanews.com. Sonny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. For those of you who don't have email access, write this down. The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. We appreciate your contributions, so drop us a line when you get a chance.
For the first time, Africa had two teams in the knockout stage at the World Cup. With Nigeria now knocked out by France, only Algeria remains to contest for a quarterfinal berth in this tournament. For an assessment of the performance of the Africa's teams, let's go to Lagos and join Nightline Africa's Segun on the dot at DMA. Hello, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas. Despite the chaos and early elimination of three out of five African teams in Brazil, Africa has made history at this World Cup. Looking past the bonus disputes and strike threats, it's notable that Africa has two teams in the last 16. Never before has more than one African nation gone through at one World Cup. Now, of the five African teams in Brazil, three of them have had their World Cup campaigns seriously affected by pay and discipline problems. Ghana, a quarterfinalist in 2010, had to go as far as flying hard cash to Brazil on a plane to keep the players committed to the decisive group game against Portugal. Cameroon's squad had refused to travel to Brazil until their demands for better bonuses were met. And African champion Nigeria, days before its first knockout game at the World Cup since 1998, cancelled a training session on Thursday to talk about money. The pay is seriously distracting from the play. The problem is not new to African teams. It happened with Togo, at the World Cup in 2006. But it's happening more frequently now, enough for FIFA to take notice. At the core of it is a lack of trust between players and their national federations that what is promised to players before a World Cup is actually delivered after it. Apart from pay disputes, there's also the problem of discipline. Ghana had two key players, Kevin Prince Boateng and Sule Muntari, sent home for insubordination. Cameroon lost a player to red card, while two others engaged in headbutting during a crucial match. To what extent has indiscipline affected the chances of the African teams at this tournament? I put this and other questions to Segun Aribike, a sports analyst and a former editor-in-chief of the news agency of Nigeria.
Let me start by saying that indiscipline is not a problem of Africa only. The example of the French at the 2010 World Cup comes to mind. Having said that, indiscipline among African teams appears more rampant. Usually the problem is over money. Naturally, indiscipline affects the chances of African teams. Ghana played very well against Germany and could have won that game. That was before their suspension problem. But against Portugal, Ghana was poor, and it wasn't surprising that they lost.
Do you think the Ghana Football Association was right to have dismissed two key players, Sule Muntari and Kevin Prince Boateng, before the team's all-important final group game against Portugal on Thursday?
Yes, the Ghana FA was right to send Sule Muntari and Kevin Boateng home for alleged acts of indiscipline. No individual can be bigger than their country.
Boateng was said to have verbally assaulted coach Kwesi Appiah. He could not have done this to a European coach. Why do African players disrespect African coaches?
Yes, the Ghanaian FA said Boateng assaulted the coach. It is unfortunate if he did that. A player of his caliber should know better. But that type of behavior is not limited to African players. European players have been known to fight their coaches too. A good example is Balotelli and his coach at Manchester United, Roberto Mancini. So I think disrespecting a coach is a human thing and not limited to African footballers. Joey Barthing, an English player, has had his own fair share of problems with coaches.
What needs to be done to stem these acts of indiscipline by African players, especially at such a big stage as the World Cup?
As I said earlier, the major cause of indiscipline among African players at tournaments is money. I think it is important to discuss with the players what they are to be paid for their services, and the agreement must be kept or honored by both sides. You don't change the terms after you have agreed. For example, the players cannot and should not change their demand because they are doing well at the tournament, while the administrators shouldn't alter the terms too because the team is not playing well. Secondly, the players should realize that the coach has the final say on who gets to play.
Finally, how would you assess the performance of African teams so far in Brazil?
So far, so good. Out of five representatives, Africa has two in the round of 16. That comes to about 40% compared to Europe with 13 participants, but have only six in the second round. That gives you around about 46%. And if I may add, I think Ivory Coast lost to inexperience and Ghana to indiscipline.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Segun Aribike, a sports analyst and a former editor-in-chief of the news agency of Nigeria. He spoke with me right here in Lagos. Meanwhile, Ghana's sports minister and his deputy were reassigned to other ministerial duties on Saturday following the Black Stars' disappointing performance at the World Cup. A statement from President John Dramani Mahama's office said that Minister of Youth and Sports, Elvis Afrie Ankra, would become a junior minister at the presidency. Deputy Minister of Youth and Sports, Joseph Yamin, has been reassigned to be a deputy minister in the Ashanti region. Despite high hopes in Ghana and a talented squad, the Black Stars failed to advance beyond the group stage after losing to the United States and Portugal and recording a draw with Germany. Finally, ahead of their second round clash against France on Monday, the Super Eagles of Nigeria have been given some tips by a soccer expert. Stanley Eguma is the manager of Dolphins Football Club of Port Harcourt in southern Nigeria. He speaks on the Nigeria-France match.
France has been very fantastic and they've been scoring goals. Karim Benzema has been on a goal spree. So I expect Nigerians to be very, very careful, you know, in their defense and expect to play with a lot of confidence, you know. Yeah, the French team is playing with a lot of compactness in the midfield where you have Pogba, you know, combining well with Karim Benzema and other strikers that, you know, swinging the passes to them. So I think they have a very good midfield and the attack is very, very potent.
That was Stanley Eguma speaking on the second round match between Nigeria and France on Monday at the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil. Many thanks to reporter Tony Tamuno for the audio. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Umpuga in Washington.
Thanks, Segun. Now let's join Daybreak Africa's sportsman Mark Holman in Johannesburg, South Africa, for more on Africa's team remaining in this year's World Cup.
Perhaps the most emotional encounter will feature Africa's highest-placed side on the current FIFA rankings, the Algerian Desert Fox, who engaged Germany in Porto Alegre. Algeria aimed to bury the ghost of the 1982 World Cup in Spain, where after beating the fancied West Germans 2-1, they were, along with many other Africans, infuriated by the dull, scoreless draw between West Germany and their neighbors, Austria. The result meant Algeria were eliminated amid widespread anger that the European neighbors were allegedly involved in match fixing. Subsequently, FIFA ruled that all last group fixtures are played simultaneously so as to protect the integrity of their competitions. This has since been adopted at major football competitions worldwide.
That report by Marco Oman in Johannesburg, South Africa, brings us to the end of this edition of the Sunnyside Sport. I'm Douglas Impoga. Sunny will be back tomorrow. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunnyside of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunnyside of Sports at 17:30 UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
In our feature segment, an encore presentation of the first part of a five-part series that takes us inside South Africa's craft beer boom. And next, in South Sudan, the United Nations mission is constructing a 17-kilometer dike on the Nile River. But first, some music. Here is J.I. of Tanzania with Choo Choo Choo.
Choo choo choo.
ukiamka pengine za kukosa mtoto mwisho wae mamano siku jana sijalala naisi nikilala ukiamka pengine za kukosa chuu 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 Sindano yangu inapoingia Utamu kichogoni wani nyungunyea Kila nilio napo hili langu huwa Minyuki nalisugilea Sindano yangu inapoingia
JIF Tanzania with Choo Choo Choo.
Well, South Africa is experiencing an unprecedented rise in demand for craft beer. This is handcrafted beer produced in small quantities in small independent breweries. It contains no chemicals and preservatives. These brewers use only pure inputs, usually hops, barley, malt, yeast, and water. The craft beer's flavors develop naturally, and it's much tastier than commercial beer. Craft brews take longer to produce and use more expensive ingredients. As a result, they are pricier than beers made on a large scale. In the first part of our five-part series, Darren Taylor takes us inside South Africa's craft beer boom.
Just a few years ago, there were a handful of small independent breweries in South Africa. Now, artisanal beer brewer Moritz Kalmeier says there are more than 70.
It was like overnight. Taken off like a snowstorm the last, I would say, 2 years.
Brewer André de Beer, famous as the man with the most appropriate name in the country's craft beer sector, says South Africa is riding the cusp of a beer revolution.
We're living in very exciting times. The variety of beer that has become available is amazing, and it's such good news.
Pubs and restaurants selling specialty beer are opening up all over. Craft beer festivals are everywhere. Winemakers are abandoning their vines to make beer. Brewing clubs are in all major cities. Newspapers are filled with articles on beer, breweries, and brewers. Lucy Korn is the author of South Africa's Bible of craft beer, African Brew. For her, it's all a bit overwhelming.
I get fed up of hearing the phrase craft beer, to be honest. It's just everywhere all the time.
Inside the Black Horse Brewery in the Magaliesberg region in Gauteng province, Nushka Buerta pours water into a big copper vat and stirs the mixture with a giant wooden paddle.
In the mashing process, this is basically a big pot with a spoon in it, and you put your water in and your barley. This stirs and it extracts all the sugars and starches out of the barley into the water.
Buerta says South Africans want craft beer because it's more flavorful, using natural ingredients discovered by the first brewers in Europe many centuries ago.
It's not syrups and corn and rice and all kinds of funny stuff that we brew with. We try and brew with the most purest products we can get.
Microbrewers like De Beer see themselves as beer artists, always willing to experiment, even at the risk of failure, in their pursuit of perfect beer.
Craft beer is made by somebody that's got a passion for it, and that passion will show in the end product. Commercial beer, unfortunately, quite too often is brewed by accountants.
A crowd of men and women throng the Stanley Beer Yard in Johannesburg. Its decor is eclectic, including the heads of dead buffalo and antelope on the walls, religious effigies, and cattle whips. Here, Yuri Blomiris keeps his customers doused with exclusive brews. Blomiris says he's built his business around craft beer because it's special.
The way it's brewed and the way it's nurtured, you can taste it. It's not as gassy, that actually has distinctive flavors.
But amid all the hype, Kalmeier says the blossoming industry should remember the times when microbrewers battled to survive in South Africa. He opened Drayman's Brewery in Pretoria more than 15 years ago.
For me, that was an extremely painful survival period of my life. I had very little money to start the brewery, so I started the brewery from scratch with nothing.
And Kalmayr almost ended up with nothing, because relatively few people wanted to drink his English ales. He says up until recently, he was still praying that South Africans would wake up and smell the beer, in his words, and realize that there was far more to beer than bland, fizzy, mass-produced lagers. Now that this is happening, Kalmayr says he can't quite believe it, and that he now makes more money at one weekend festival than he used to make in a year. 200 people gather in a hall in a brewery on the outskirts of Johannesburg. There's a man dressed like Elvis in a white jumpsuit, face caked with smeared makeup, celebrating his bachelor party. There's also a groom in a tuxedo en route to his wedding. They're all here to listen to a brewer talk about craft beer.
Right, ladies, gentlemen, good morning. Welcome to Gilroy's.
Steve Gilroy opened his microbrewery 13 years ago. His bittersweet ales now make it one of the most successful in South Africa. But like Kalmayr, Gilroy remembers the tough early years of almost begging people to drink his products.
I did the first 8 years. Every Saturday and Sunday, and Friday sometimes, I was in bottle stores saying, "Sir, would you like to try my beer?"
These days, Gilroy regularly puts up a full house sign outside his brew house. Across South Africa, in places like Gilroy's and the Stanley Beer Yard, the craft beer insanity shows no sign of fading anytime soon. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Thank you, Darren, and congratulations to Darren on this series, which won the Sanlam Excellence in Financial Journalism Award in the category of Best Multimedia Journalist of the Year. Sanlam is one of the largest financial services groups in South Africa.
In South Sudan, the United Nations mission is building a 17-kilometer dike on the Nile River. Planners say they hope the trench will help prevent flash floods, which last year displaced nearly 70,000 people in Jonglei State alone. However, some families living near the Nile are concerned they could be displaced by the project. Jacob Aishek has the story from the Jonglei State capital of Bor.
Last year, flood displaced 14,000 households in and around Bor County alone. Many houses were destroyed, and I am sure Panapit, Legiak, and Panjak suburb, as well as the market in Bor, Marol neighborhood, were more than 3 feet underwater. To stop the flooding, the military engineering unit of the Korean contingency of the United Nations mission in South Sudan is building the dike from Point Zero in Malwalchad, a village located about 5 kilometers from the town center, northward through Arek. Officials say once completed, the projects will prevent future flooding in Bor County and attract investors to the area. Member of Parliament Philip Thonyok, who represents the area, said once completed, the project should not only prevent future flooding in Bor County, but attract investors.
It will take water and pitch to the rivers. They use, at all those times, they used to have some pitch, especially during the dry season. Also, where we are passing now, there are no houses. We were there. There were small gardens. They will benefit a lot from the dike because it will close out the water and their places where they are cultivating will be dry.
Deng Mawel, owner of Upperside Junction's lodge in Bor High Mature Suburb, said he lost more than 40,000 South Sudanese pounds during last year's floods.
We are very happy for the dike we just saw. It started from Malwalchad. So we saw it. If we reach up to where we are, we'll be very happy because I get a lot of loss because I rent the place to one of Ethiopian. He rent my place. He just pay me 42,000 for 2 months. So at the time the flood come, he came and he asked me the money. I returned the money to him for the 42,000.
Malwalchad resident Kurlual also welcomed the construction of the new dike, but think it should be extended beyond 17 kilometers.
The construction of the dye is good, but only that the other side going to Malalchad area, I'm seeing as my observation, when the flood is going to come back, the area of Malalchad will be flooded, and this side of Malalchad barrack will be safe. So I was suggesting the dye not to be started from Gumbo place. It's supposed to be put up to Jawong.
The project was proposed by the state government 2 years ago but was never built due to a lack of funds. Amor Kwal is Jonglei Physical Infrastructure Minister.
If we calculate in terms of money, and if the Koreans were charging us, we would have run away from that thing. But it is an inbuilt project by the Koreans. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money, and they didn't want to tell us the price.
Government officials said the Koreans' build dike should be finished in 30 days. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Echek in Bor, Jonglei State.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a closely watched election, seen as a test of civilian rule, voters in Ekiti State, Nigeria, have chosen Dr. Ayo Fayose as their next governor. With a heavy turnout on June 21st, Dr. Fayose received more than 203,000 votes, topping the incumbent, Dr. Kayode Fayeme, who received some 120,000. Dr. Fayeme quickly conceded the results, setting the stage for a smooth transition of power when the new governor takes office in October. In a democracy, the people choose their leaders, making their voices heard on election day. In a democracy, leaders put the public interest above their own and heed the voices heard at the polls. The United States commends Governor Fayeme on graciously accepting the election results. "Election must not be seen as a do-or-die affair," he said. "I believe we must build this democracy to a mature end rather than pull it down. We urge all parties to accept the outcome in the same spirit, as representing the will of Ekiti's voting public." Nigeria's democratic system will be further tested in the months ahead. Voters in the southwest Nigerian state of Osun go to the polls in another off-cycle gubernatorial election on August 9th, and in February 2015, the nation will pick its next president during general elections. The voting in Ekiti should lend confidence to the Nigerian public and international community that the nation's independent National Electoral Commission, security forces, and the political parties have the capacity to conduct themselves in a manner that strengthens Nigeria's democracy and gives political voice to its population.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.